her body was discovered in a nearby wooded area.
He was stabbed 19 times and left for dead,
where two adults have been shot to death.
143 people have been murdered. Hundreds more have been shot.
She had been stabbed to death.
It was the bloodiest scene I think I've ever been to.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Dark and Deadly. We are your hosts. I'm Haley.
And I'm Gina.
And I think we have decided that from here on out, we're going to switch things up. I just had a stroke. We're going to switch things up a bit. And so, Gina, do you kind of want to explain what our plans are for the podcast here in the next few months?
Okay, so here's the plan for the next couple months. We have decided to shake things up a tiny bit. What Haley and I have observed and how we feel also is that the episodes where we have you guys pick the theme are the ones that we really enjoy the best. And it seems that you guys enjoy them the best too. So what we're going to do over the next 2 months is we're going to take a hiatus. We're so sorry. Another one, I know, but this will be better for all of us involved. We're going to take the next 2 months. We're going to research 10 episodes for you guys. We're going to record them, have them all ready to go, and then we will have a consistent release schedule. Monday at 8 a.m. the episodes will be released. This means that over the next 2 months, we're going to be putting out surveys. We're going to still be telling you guys about cases, giving you good information, and probably be more up-to-date cases, like people who are currently missing. We'll be posting Instagram posts about that.
Right. And even so, we'll get a little bit more involved on the TikTok, just kind of giving you smaller videos of, you know, the information that you all like to hear about. So it'll just be a condensed podcast on our TikTok.
Yes.
And this just, it's going to end up, the quality and everything is just going to be better. We're going to be more consistent with the uploads and everything. And if we sound different today, we did have to record remote today. So that's the kind of stuff that we are wanting to not necessarily avoid, but we want to put out better, higher quality content for you guys, which means an entire revamp of what we're doing, because we want this to be successful. We want you guys to enjoy it. And that's how we think that this would get us there, pretty much.
Right. So we'll be releasing in seasons. And the good thing is that with us doing 10 episodes, that's 10 weeks of content. So we can kind of shorten that time between seasons for you guys. So
right.
More to come on that.
And let us know too, if you guys, what your preferences are on how many seasons should be, or how many episodes should be in a season. And, you know, this will be kind of starting, like almost starting over again, because we're learning this new process with kind of a different objective, I guess, in mind. So we want to also hear what you guys like. So is 10 episodes too much? Is it like just right? How long between seasons do you like to wait for new episodes to come out? Let us know those kind of things and stay interactive with us, because we're not leaving forever.
Exactly. We're here. We'll just be working hard.
Yes. In the background. Yes. Okay. So are we ready for the case today?
Mm-hmm. So weird. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Okay. On Monday, February 24th, 1986, John Rutten returned from work around 6 p.m. to his home. And when he pulled into the driveway of his condo that he shared with his wife, Sherry Rasmussen, he found a very concerning scene. So the way that their condo was set up is like, you know how some condos, when you are driving down the main road, like it's the front of the house. Mm-hmm. And then if you were to go around a back alley, that's where the driveways, the garages would be.
Yeah.
That kind of situation that is what we're working with. So In his specific condo, there was a balcony right above the garage. And so he pulls into the driveway. There's glass all over. He looks up and sees that the sliding glass doors that go out to this balcony are broken. and the garage door was left wide open, and his wife's new BMW was missing. So he pulls into the garage, and when he walks inside, he was stunned to find Sherry still in a robe, beaten and shot three times on her living room, on their living room floor.
Oh my gosh.
John and Sherry had only been married for 3 months. Mm. They got married in November, and their relationship was kind of like a whirlwind romance, to say the least. Sherry was an absolutely incredible human being since the day she was born. And she was born on February 7th, 1957. So again, she died right after her birthday, right after Valentine's Day, right after they got married.
Oh,
it's so sad.
That is sad.
So she was born in Walla Walla, Washington to Nels and Loretta Rasmussen. And she was the middle child of three sisters, which God bless her parents. Her older sister was Connie and her younger sister was Teresa. And the parents actually moved from Walla Walla to Tucson, Arizona, where Nels was a dentist and owned his own practice. And Loretta was their office manager. So Sherry grew up incredibly smart. She had brilliant people for parents. She was super hardworking. She excelled so much in school that she graduated from elementary school a year early and then graduated a high school at 16 years old.
Oh, wow.
Crazy.
Very smart.
She was one of those people who didn't feel like they were ever doing enough. So she was constantly studying. And even when her plate was loaded with things, she rarely failed at whatever it was. And if in the off chance that she did fail, she would use that as a learning experience and master whatever it was. I mean, she was just an incredible human being. So after high school, she attended college at La Sierra University in California. Like I said, she was only 16 years old when she began college, which is insane to me. Her older sister, Connie, was studying to be a nurse at the time. And with her father's background in dentistry, her sister and aunt was also a nurse. She felt kind of right at home in the medical field. So Sherry made the decision to also pursue a career in nursing. She applied to nursing school at Loma Linda, where Connie was studying. And of course, she was accepted in the fall of 1974. And the two sisters actually graduated together in 1977, which is also crazy because Connie was there longer than her. I think that just attests to how incredibly smart and hard she worked.
Right.
So she was only 20 years old and had graduated with her nursing degree. And as if that wasn't impressive enough, in September 1978, she decided to go for her master's at UCLA while also working as a nurse at their medical center, which meant she was not only working full-time, but also going to school full-time to get her master's degree.
So she loved to learn. I mean, to be doing loved that much school. How old was she when she got her master's?
She was 23 years old.
Oh my gosh.
I believe. Because at 23 in 1980, she was credentialed as a cardiovascular clinical nurse specialist.
Wow.
She was high up there.
How impressive. And
right? It kind of makes me feel like I have done absolutely nothing with my life.
Just, I'm thankful that there are people like that out there.
Yeah, me too. That was really the start of just an amazing, but sadly short-lived career for her.
Oh.
Because she would have excelled in nursing. She loved what she did. And I think people even really respected and loved her, which is, she was probably one of the youngest people to be in the position that she was. Like, if you think about it, there's most of the people that were probably below her were so much older than her, had so much more experience than her, and yet she was killing it in her early 20s.
Completely.
So as a graduation gift, her father actually purchased her the condo that we were talking about earlier. And although he'd purchased it for her, Sherry was super independent. She didn't take handouts. So she insisted on writing her father a check every single month to pay for the mortgage. I think he probably ended up just putting some money down and, you know, with his credit, he was the owner of the home. But I mean, she paid for her house. She paid for her things. She was a very independent lady. Mm-hmm. So at 27 years old, Glendale Adventist hired her as director of critical nursing. Fast forward only a few months later, she attends a party where she meets John, and this is where their whirlwind romance began. That's a hard word to say. John Rutten was born on the 5th of September in 1958 in Eugene, Oregon. And he was one of four children, and his parents raised him and his siblings in San Diego. In 1981, he graduated with a mechanical engineering degree from UCLA. So these two were very smart people and very attractive people. They were both beautiful human beings. When they first met at that party, John was immediately infatuated with Sherry, as many probably were. I know you hear it a lot, and it's like so cliche to say in these cases, but she literally lit up any room that she walked in. But everybody would just say, that's just Sherry. That's how she was. She was just always a light to be around. And she looked like a model. She was 6'1".
So, whoa, tall.
Yeah, taller than me, and I'm tall.
Mm-hmm.
They really hit it off that night, and after going their separate ways, John reached out to their mutual friend to get Sherry's number. And as they say, the rest is history. If you ask John, he would tell you it was love at first sight, and the couple got engaged not long after meeting in May of 1985.
Oh.
And instead of an engagement ring, he bought her a brand new BMW. And that was, I mean, that was a fast relationship. John moved into the condo that Nels bought for his daughter, which at this point, Nels switched the ownership over to the couple. So he signed his name off the title of the home and passed it along to his daughter.
Oh.
On November 23rd, 1985, they were married, and they spent the next month in pure newlywed bliss. The holidays were fantastic, spending time with their family and their friends and adjusting to being a married couple, which was unfortunately so short-lived. And I'm not saying that they were the perfect couple. There was lots of, you know, issues, which we'll get into leading up to this, but they probably would still be married today, I think, if she wasn't murdered. So, the morning of February 24th, John got up to get ready for work. He normally left before Sherry because he had to be at work a little bit earlier than her. And sometimes she wasn't even really awake before he left. But this morning, he was still around when Sherry woke up and told him that she wasn't feeling really well and was more than likely going to be calling in sick to work that day. So John said he would call her later that morning after he got to work to check on her. And he did just that. But when he called her, she didn't answer. He didn't really think much of it because when you're sick, normally you're sleeping. So he assumed that she was probably just sleeping and decided to give her a call another 30 minutes later. And that time she didn't answer either. But like I said, when people are sick, they're probably not right next to the phone. Especially in those days, you didn't have a cell phone at your hip.
Right.
So he didn't think it was alarming or anything. Just to cover all of his bases, though, he figured he would call over to her work and see if she decided to go in. When he called, her secretary answered and told him that she didn't see Sherry that morning, but that she might still be there. It was a Monday, and her secretary didn't normally see her on Mondays because she taught classes typically or had meetings that kept her busy enough to be away from the desk. So, in short, just because her secretary hadn't seen her yet didn't mean that she wasn't there. So, the only thing that John found a little bit peculiar was that if she had left that day, the voicemail, like the message machine was still off. These are back in the days when you had to turn those things on and off, and she was very good about turning it on before she left the house each day. So he figured that she was still there, and when he kept calling her and she wasn't answering, it was a little bit worrisome, but not enough for him to
like call the cops.
Right. So at around 10 a.m., Sherry's sister, Teresa, also tried calling the office to get in touch with her. And at this point, the secretary told her that she'd called in sick, that she hadn't been there today to her knowledge, the same thing that she told John earlier. At 6 o'clock, when John arrived home that evening, we know that he finds his wife brutally murdered on their living room floor. And the scene he walked into was traumatizing, to say the least. Sherry had been deceased for quite some time because rigor mortis was starting to set in. So it's probably likely that it happened not too long after he left the home that morning. She was stiff, beaten, bitten, and shot. The living room was also in disarray. There was a stereo with the cords pulled out of the wall, like different electronics sitting by the front door, a broken vase, scattered furniture, blood streaks on the wall and on the front door. Investigators could obviously tell that there was some sort of altercation that happened there. Sherry was shot in total 3 times at point blank range, and any of those shots on their own would have killed her. So 3 was overkill.
Almost like they were upset with her.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually read this in, there was a couple of different sources, so I'm not going to say 100% that this is what her actual gunshot wounds locations were. I'm going to use the documentary's version because I feel like other than articles, that might be probably the more correct version of it. But again, I'm not going to say for sure this is what could what actually happened, because I did not find any autopsy type photos to reference. So in the documentary, it says that she was shot 2 times in the upper torso, below her collarbone. I think one of them penetrated her heart. The other one was more over towards the shoulder, the left shoulder. And then the 3rd one was in the abdomen. Okay, I just wanted to pop on here really quick and say I did end up finding the autopsy report for Sherry. The gunshot wound number 1 was to the mid-chest, 17 inches from the top of the head. Gunshot number 2 was just above the left breast, 16 inches from the top of the head. And gunshot number 3 was to the lower left chest, 21 inches from the top of the head. So I'm sorry I did not include that in the initial podcast. This is a little extra recording in here. I just wanted to hop on and let you guys know the factual information from the autopsy report taken from the crime scene.
Wow.
So all of those alone would probably cause you enough internal damage and bleeding to like bleed out.
Oh, fully.
So.
How sad.
Definitely overkill. Mm-hmm. And one officer on scene discovered a bullet hole in a blanket, which could mean that what more than likely happened is that her attacker used the blanket to muffle the sound as they shot her the additional times after the first one. Investigators right off the bat determined this was the result of a robbery gone wrong. I mean, if you survey the scene, that's kind of what it ends up looking like at first glance. Although there was no forced entry into the home, there were a lot of robberies that had been occurring near the neighborhood. Although the only things that were stolen were her BMW, which we talked about was missing from the garage. It was found days after with the key still in it, in the ignition. And the second thing that was stolen was John and Sherry's marriage certificate. Nothing else was missing from the home, even though the stereo was sitting there. They had TVs. Sherry owned lots of jewelry. Her purse was still there. Their marriage certificate and her car.
Weird.
They believe Sherry fought as hard as she could against her attacker or attackers, as they thought this was more than likely 2 male suspects that were causing the other robberies. And additionally to the gunshot wounds, she also had a bite mark on the inner side of her left forearm. So they took a DNA swab of the saliva from the bite mark, and impressions were done in hopes of, you know, getting a dental match in the future. There was very little evidence as to who could have done this, though, other than those 2 male suspects that they were not able to identify. They obviously looked at John first, but he had an airtight alibi since he was working all day, and he was extremely distraught over the fact that his very new bride was gone forever. He was absolutely traumatized. Without a suspect, there was nothing they could do but hopefully find these 2 men they assumed murdered Sherry. But to her family and even to her husband, they were looking in the wrong direction. Her family and friends were confused as to why they were zoning in so hard on a botched robbery when the evidence suggested otherwise. Like, why would you come in and steal a marriage certificate? And if you're going to get a BMW, why would you leave it down the road? You know?
Yeah.
For one thing, a gun fired at point blank range suggested that the killer was probably someone who wanted Sherry dead rather than someone who just was caught in the act of trying to steal things. And not only that, like, why would you only steal the marriage license and the BMW? And history shows that, generally speaking, robberies are usually committed by men and bite marks are usually left by women, except for Ted Bundy. He was special.
I think that's so bizarre that women usually leave bite marks.
It's, yeah.
But I guess when you're fighting, mm-hmm. you're struggling with someone, women would probably go for, yep, we'd probably go for our teeth. Ew, gross.
And see, that's where I also, I think in a podcast, I had heard about this case that, and I couldn't find this in my actual research, so I'm not sure if this is true, but it does make sense to me that if Sherry had put possibly the attacker in a headlock, I mean, she was 6'1". So if this person, say, was a female or a smaller male, she could have probably fought back to the point where maybe she put that person in a headlock and that person bit her.
Oh, to get out of it?
To free her arm. Yeah.
Get free out of her arm. I could see that.
Right? So yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I also was not able to find if this bite was pre or post-mortem. So that could also be pretty telling of, is it somebody who just like is so literally angry and they're not finished after they have shot her that they go back in with something a little bit more personal, or is it done beforehand in the altercation? It could go both ways. I just think that the altercation way is probably more likely.
Wow.
So Knowles confided in Detective Mayer, who is the lead investigator on his daughter's case, that they should be looking into a woman by the name of Stephanie Lazarus. He told the authorities that Stephanie had threatened Sherry on a number of occasions. So, who is Stephanie, you may be wondering. Do you want to take a guess?
Is she sleeping with the husband?
Well, kind of. She was a former lover of John's. And apparently was still very much in love with him. According to John, their relationship wasn't much of a relationship. Although it lasted a few years and they had met each other's families and stuff, John never really considered them to be exclusive or like in a relationship. They were just friends with benefits. Oh. She did not see it that way.
Of course.
Yeah. When John met Sherry, Stephanie didn't exist in John's world anymore. Stephanie grew extremely envious of that relationship, especially when she found out through a friend that the couple was engaged to be married.
Oh, no.
Nels told authorities that his daughter confided in him once, saying that Stephanie showed up to her work one day at the hospital and told her, if I can't have John, no one else will. And when your marriage falls apart, I will be here to pick up the pieces.
Stephanie's dad told detectives that?
No. So Stephanie showed up at the hospital. Sherry told her dad that, and the dad Sherry's told the dad detective.
Detectives. Oh my gosh.
Yes. And want to take a guess as to why the police brushed off this suspect?
She was pretty?
No, she happened to be a police officer with the LAPD.
Oh God.
Uh-huh. Even John himself told the authorities to possibly look into Stephanie, and nothing was done about it.
Are you kidding me?
At this point, no. And at this point, John goes quiet and steps into the background of the investigation. And Sherry's family and friends were kind of annoyed by this and expressed that if the roles were reversed, Sherry would have done everything in her power to try and find out what happened to her husband.
Right. Well, that has to make him look guilty to the family, but.
Right. Well, they never suspected him. The dad did say in an interview, we never suspected John. They were just kind of upset that he didn't, you know, wasn't like out there more in the media. Like, please help us find who did this.
Yeah.
If you did this, come forward. You know, for whatever reason, he didn't have much involvement in the case after that. But I can also understand it to some degree because you're going through this grieving process and it's not black and white for everybody. And I can only imagine the feeling of absolute defeat when you go to the police and say, hey, you might want to check into my ex. There have been some issues in the past. And they consistently act like it's no big deal.
Right.
You know, so I also probably would not want to have anything to do with the police department that is not listening to me. So I understand it.
No, I wouldn't probably either.
And Nels consistently for days after the murder kept telling the lead investigator, just look into Stephanie. It is worth looking into. And at one point, Detective Mayer got so annoyed, he actually told this grieving father that he was watching too much TV. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have the husband and the father telling you to look into something or someone, regardless if they're a police officer or not, you better look into it. That's your job.
Yep. Fully.
They didn't, though, and for 23 years, this case went cold.
That's upsetting.
In December 2004, a criminalist by the name of Jennifer Butterworth dug into this case a little more, and come to find out, some evidence was lost. Imagine that. And the evidence that was lost happened to be the DNA sample from the saliva.
Are you kidding me?
Not kidding.
So I actually have a, and I probably can research this. Does anything ever happen to police departments when they lose evidence? Like,
I don't think so.
Do they get in trouble, or it's just like, no, we lost it?
They probably get written up.
Oh, Lord.
And especially back in, you know, the 80s, there probably wasn't a whole lot of, I feel like more so now you have more of a paper trail for things.
Mm-hmm.
And probably back then it probably wasn't as strict.
Damn.
You'd sign out evidence and then be like, oh, well, I returned that, but I forgot to sign it back in or something, you know?
Right.
So Jennifer contacted the coroner's office, hoping and praying that somehow they might have it there. And thankfully, they were able to locate it shoved in a place it wasn't supposed to be in the first place, obviously. And when the DNA was tested, they were stunned to conclude that the DNA, without a doubt, belonged to a woman. And this entire time, remember, they're still thinking, oh, this was a botched burglary. It was probably two men. So when they get this and they run the evidence through CODIS, unfortunately, nothing comes up. They come up empty-handed. And once again, the case sat vacant until around 2009 when two LAPD detectives began reviewing the case once again. And the fact that a woman's DNA was now in the mix helped out, you know, helped put these pieces together to a case that should have been solved over two decades ago if police would have just listened in the first place.
Ugh, I hate these.
They combed through the file and came across a short list of women who could be involved in the case, and they ended up narrowing down, zeroing in on one name that kept reoccurring over and over and over again, and that was Stephanie Lazarus. And then they soon discovered that their prime suspect happened to be one of their own. So at this point in their investigation, they did what any smart detective would do, and they kept it on the down low. They didn't talk about it.
Right.
The details surrounding Stephanie's involvement were starting to pile up. Her name was brought up multiple times during the initial investigation, only to be brushed off. The DNA was that of a female. Sherry had very few enemies, and Stephanie was heartbroken over the fact that he chose Sherry over her. And then, not long after the murder, Stephanie reported her personal .38 caliber pistol had been stolen out of her vehicle. And Sherry Rasmussen was murdered with a .38 caliber pistol.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
How odd.
Right? So they researched Lazarus in the police database to find out that she was currently assigned to the art theft detail, which I did not know was an actual thing. Like,
I didn't either.
I didn't know that stolen art was actually that big of an issue, which is kind of interesting, but yeah. I thought that was in movies. The detectives were stunned to find out that Stephanie was a well-respected officer with many years and experience under her belt. She actually began her career as a patrol officer and was eventually promoted to work in several different departments, such as internal affairs, coincidentally homicide, and the DARE program, which, if you're unaware, stands for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. And I just happened to find out, did you do DARE?
Yes.
In school?
Yes.
I just found out that it no longer exists.
Oh.
And has now been replaced by a program called Keeping It Real.
Oh, okay.
Stephanie had a clean record and was well-liked among her colleagues and friends, and she went on to marry a fellow detective years after Sherry was murdered, and the two of them adopted a daughter together. Ooh. So with all these clues coming together, and the evidence piling up against Lazarus, the two detectives set out to collect some of her DNA, and they were able to trail her and collect a cup that she had thrown away. They got it and tested it and were shocked to find out that the chances of the sample belonging to anyone other than Stephanie was a 1.7 sextillion to one chance.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. In order to make their arrest, the detectives had to play it cool. So here you have somebody who has years of experience and guidance on dealing with murderers and criminals, and she happens to be a murderer. So the likelihood of her finding out what's happening and things exploding in their face are very high at this point. They play it off as though they were investigating an art theft and that they were going to interview her, well, interview a suspect and bring her in on it.
Mm-hmm.
To believe, like, they told her, hey, we have this guy who we believe is a stolen art thief. Will you come in and help us with this interview? And she said, yeah, of course. On June 5th, 2009, they bring her into the investigation room and ask her, hey, do you not know John Rutten? And she's like, do you mean a John Rutten? And obviously they did this on purpose. They know how to say his name. But from there, they start asking her questions about John and Sherry. And the interview is super interesting. She basically talks herself into a circle about 100 times. And it's interesting to see how she reacts to certain questions. I'm going to play some clips here for you guys. And then I'm also going to link the interrogation in the show notes so that everybody can go watch it. It's really interesting to see how her body language changes depending on what she's being asked. So when she's giving straight facts, like how do you pronounce John's last name? Or where was John and Sherry's condo? She's super collected and to the point because it's an actual factual question. She can give the truth. Truthful answer, right? When they ask her about if she's had any conversation or altercations with Sherry, she's super frantic and unorganized, and her questions or the answers to her questions are not rehearsed.
We've been assigned a case that we've been looking at.
Okay.
It's a new case, and reviewing the case, there's some notes to see that as far as your name being mentioned. Do you know John Rutten?
John Rutten?
Rutten.
Oh, yeah, I went to school with him.
You did?
Yeah.
How long did you know him?
Gosh, I went to school in, went to UCLA in 1978. I started and, met him at school at the dorms.
Mm-hmm. Were you guys friends, close friends?
Yeah, we're very close friends.
Yeah?
I mean, what's this all about?
Well, it's regarding, it's a case we're working on, and it involves John, and in there, some of the statements we reviewed, there's notes and stuff that he knew you and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were good friends. I lived in the dorms for 2 years.
You guys lived in the same dorm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Dykstra.
Okay. Were you guys just friends or anything else? Or?
Yeah, we were good friends.
Yeah. Was there ever any relationship or anything that developed between you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we dated. What's this all about?
Well, it's relating to his wife.
Okay.
Okay. Did you know her?
Not really. I mean, I knew that he got married years ago.
Uh-huh.
The men question her for about an hour before she finally basically just tells them she's getting uncomfortable. She knows how this goes. She's done this for many years. It's time for her to get a lawyer. So the men agree and tell her, we would do the same thing if we were in your shoes. You're free to walk out that door.
No, that's what we're telling you. I mean, you're free to go whenever you want. If this makes you uncomfortable and you want
to... Now you're starting to make me uncomfortable.
The thing is, I mean, detectives did what they could at that time on the crime scene. Okay? And the burglary thing you're talking about, that is an angle that they looked at. I go, but now we're looking at everything else on the case. Because nobody was ever arrested on the case.
I don't know that or not.
Okay. Now, what we'd like to do is... Obviously, you know about all the DNA stuff and things of the nature that, gets done on cases nowadays. You know, if we asked you for a DNA swab, would you be willing to give us one?
Maybe. Because
now
I'm thinking I probably need to talk to a lawyer.
Okay.
I mean...
Well...
Because I know how this stuff works, okay? Don't get me wrong. You're right. I have been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
And I wish I had been recording this because now it sounds like, there's... you know, you're selling these people, say I'm fighting with her, and now it sounds like you're trying to, you know, I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah,
we know.
Okay, and now it almost sounds like you're trying to pin something on me. No, now I got that sense.
Well, what it gets to on these cases, and you know it as well as I do, our job is to identify and eliminate suspects.
I can't believe this.
So if we ask you to point, to give us a DNA sample, a buccal swab, so we can identify or eliminate you, would you be willing to do that?
Maybe. Because I know this.
Well, that's where we're at, too. I mean, because right now, from looking at the evidence, it's, you know, it's possible we may have some DNA at the location.
That's great.
And we're going to do what we can to try to put this thing together. And your name's in the book. These people are pointing at you for whatever reason.
I don't know why. That's just crazy. I mean, that's absolutely crazy.
And it would be irresponsible on our part not to look at it.
I know. You guys have to do your job, and I guess I'm going to have to contact somebody. So
that's fair.
I mean, because I know how this stuff works.
Sure.
I mean, I just can't believe it.
We understand that. I mean, if we were in your position, I mean, we would feel the same way.
I just can't even believe it. I mean, it's just, I'm shocked. I'm really shocked. Okay. That somebody would be saying that I did this. I mean, we had a fight, and so I went and killed her. I mean, come on.
Well,
that's...
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for giving me the courtesy. I wish I could record it.
Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, Stephanie, take care.
All right.
As soon as she leaves that room, though, she walked right into handcuffs and was read her Miranda rights. Fast forward to the trial. One interesting thing came out when John testified that after his engagement with Sherry, he had met up with Stephanie, who just wanted to talk, and she was super upset with the fact that he was now engaged to somebody else, despite the fact that her and John hadn't really spoken that much in the few months leading up to their engagement. I mean, Stephanie confessed her love for him. John told her, you know, I'm in love with Sherry. I'm going to marry Sherry. She's my wife. And then proceeded to have sex with her one last time in order to provide her with some closure.
And what were the dates on this?
I was rooting for you, John. They were before they got engaged.
But they were definitely together.
They were definitely together.
Ugh.
And I absolutely hate men. But I do believe that he had told Sherry about his infidelity because she had confronted him about Stephanie at one point.
Oh,
so
okay.
This was something that she had known about. They had worked through already before their marriage, but still. He sucks for that.
Right.
That's not closure either. Don't do that.
No.
They bring up the fact that Stephanie went to Sherry's work and practically threatened her with the if you can't have him, nobody can bullshit. And her defense lawyer gives a completely different story as to what she supposedly said on that day, which was for Sherry to tell John to quit pursuing her because they were going to get married. Insert eye roll emoji here. Sherry complained multiple times to the family and friends that she felt like she was being followed and stalked by somebody. She thought it was a woman dressed in dark men's clothing and that they had eyes that pierced your soul. And if you look at pictures of Stephanie, she has some of the craziest eyes I have ever seen in my entire life.
I guess I'm like really confused how she wasn't a suspect before this.
She wasn't what?
A suspect before this.
I know, because
if her family knew about this and he told the cops about her,
mm-hmm.
What are we doing? Because this feels like it's a slam dunk case,
you would think. But even the detectives that picked up the case in 2009, they 100% think that it is a cover-up. The defense also claimed that Stephanie wasn't as obsessed with John as everybody was making her out to be, and the argument for the DNA evidence matching to Stephanie was rocky because of how the evidence was handled over the course of 2 decades, which I can understand to some extent. The swabs that were taken were kept in a vial, obviously, and sealed in an envelope in 1986. And when that envelope was recovered in 2004, the envelope had a tear in it, and the vial was protruding from the envelope a little bit, and apparently it wasn't sealed properly. Why, though, was the evidence lost in the first place? I mean, it's really very likely that it was a police cover-up. And I'm not pointing fingers at Detective Mayer, who was the lead on this case initially, but the fact that he also adamantly refused to look into Stephanie, and then later down the road, he completely denies the fact that anybody mentioned Stephanie looking suspicious.
Of course.
Completely denies it.
Of course.
He literally tells 48 hours that neither Nels or John told him that they suspected Stephanie to be involved. Yet there are literally mentions of it in the original case files.
Like, okay, bud. Okay. So you're just forgetting things, right? Because it's been so long.
Yeah. Must have slipped my memory. Sorry. The jury took a little over a day to find Stephanie guilty of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to 27 years to life in a maximum security women's unit in California. And this cart is going to kill you, okay? At the trial, John cried in court after the ruling, saying how much of an impact Sherry had on everybody's lives that knew her, that he was proud to be her husband, and that his heart still races when he looks at her pictures.
Oh.
He then apologizes to her family because he feels partially responsible for her death. If he wouldn't have met her and asked her to marry him, she would still be there today.
Oh.
I know. I mean, but in all honesty, if it wasn't Sherry, it would have been the next girl.
Oh, yeah. Homegirl psycho.
Because it had nothing to do with John and everything to do with Stephanie being a cold-blooded killer.
Yep. So,
and that is my case on Sherry Rasmussen.
Oh, poor girl.
We're going to leave you off with a fun fact.
About serial killers, guys. Okay, yes. So get this. Jeffrey Dahmer.
Mm-hmm.
So... right before he was caught, he had so many bodies in his apartment that he ran out of room and stored one victim in the bathroom. And he would literally bathe himself. I want to throw up. He would bathe himself over the decaying body.
In his shower?
In his shower. That makes me want to throw up.
Yeah. Like, how did people not notice that he smelled like a dead body?
Exactly. Exactly. That is so nasty. That is foul.
That's so gross.
Like, I've read that before, and that makes me want to just
So,
sorry, guys.
I know. Sorry to leave you off on that note, but I think it'd be interesting to add in some serial killer facts because they're interesting people. That's why we're all here today, isn't it?
Yes.
But yeah, do we have, we'll announce the actual date of when our first official season is supposed to come out because we are still working out some last minute details on
right.
That. Would it be safe to say though, to watch out for our Instagram, for surveys to come out for topics for you guys to vote on?
Yeah,
like, so things you want to hear about.
We will have those out by Monday when this episode releases. So you guys should see that then.
Perfect.
And then you'll see them probably on like every 2 weeks we'll release one.
A survey. Yeah. All right, you guys. So we will see you guys here on our premiere date. Is that what I'm thinking of? Like, is that a good word?
Season premiere? I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds fancy. Don't forget to vote us on the Golden Globes. Alrighty, guys. Well, we hope you have a wonderful week. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Dark and Dudley Pod. We're going to continue to stay active on there and get more active on the TikTok. So hope you guys have a great week. And yeah.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.